from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, we look at the question of what is driving migrants to flee their home countries and come to the U.S.-Mexico border despite the Trump administration's crackdown. The U.N. Refugee Agency reported last month that there were nearly 300,000 registered asylum seekers and refugees from Central America at the end of 2017. That's a nearly 60% increase from a year ago because of ongoing violence from drug cartels, gangs, and governments. We look at how the violence has affected migrants' lives, what can be done about it, and whether it's the only reason they come. Join us next on Forum. Welcome to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. The Department of Health and Human Services has asked the Pentagon to prepare to house as many as 20,000 unaccompanied migrant children on American military bases. The request came hours after President Trump signed an order saying families would now be detained together, though it's unclear exactly how and where. These moves are happening as human rights agencies report an increase in the number of asylum seekers from a year ago, particularly from El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala. We take a closer look this hour at what's happening in the Northern Triangle of Central America and what it means when we hear that violence is driving people from this region to flee. We go first, though, to Philip Bump. He's national correspondent for The Washington Post. Good morning, Philip Bump.
Good morning.
If I could just start with getting some clarity from a Washington Post piece that says the U.S. government will no longer file criminal charges against parents who cross the border illegally. They were quoting a senior U.S. customs official. Is that true, that they will not be prosecuted criminally?
So our reporting suggests that there has been a change in that regard in terms of what the Border Patrol and what customs officials are going to be doing. It's important to note that a lot of this is really murky, that the law prior to President Trump signing the executive order earlier this week was at least pretty clear. There was zero tolerance. Everyone was being prosecuted. There was no bail being set. At this point, it's a little less clear. We've seen, for example, news reports that some people had their hearings canceled, hearings that were supposed to involve prosecutions, that those were canceled. That happened yesterday to 17 folks in Texas. We have seen other reports suggesting that the administration is scaling back in other ways. I think we're sort of still in a nebulous enough space that it's hard to say with certainty what the broad procedures are that are taking place across the Border Patrol.
And is this potential change in response to the bottlenecks in our immigration enforcement and legal processing of people at the border, that a recognition of all of the obstacles?
Well, I think to some extent. I mean, obviously the short-term change in what the administration is doing is a response to the political outcry following the emergence of the family separation policy. It is certainly the case that as people have crossed the border and given the huge backlog in immigration cases that are working their way through the courts, that adding a number of new cases as the zero tolerance policies that is still in effect has done has made that backlog or will imminently make that backlog much, much bigger, which is a problem that the government hasn't figured out how to solve. They're planning on hiring a bunch more judges, potentially, that can move through the caseload more quickly. But still, there is this massive backlog, which the zero tolerance policy only added to.
And from your reporting, are you also seeing an increase in the number of people who are coming to our southern border, the number of Border Patrol apprehensions, also the statistics from the refugee agency, the UN's refugee agency, with regard to just an increase overall of asylum seekers from Central America?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So there's been a surge over the past 3 months or so that's readily apparent in the Border Patrol's own data in terms of apprehensions on the border. And clearly there is, as you mentioned earlier, there is a relationship between this and what's going on down in Central America. And I think that's critical in context for people to keep in mind that, you know, as we're having these political debates in the United States about the effects of immigration and how we might curtail immigration, it's important to remember that pressure from Central America. It's not simply that people are deciding whether or not to cross the border in the United States. primary consideration is whether or not to actually stay in a place that they feel is dangerous for their family.
Yes, and you wrote a lengthy piece in the Washington Post about the considerations that families are making when they decide to flee their home countries. Can you just walk us through what that process is, or just some of the key elements of it?
Sure. So there are basically two broad categories of decisions that are being made. The first is how and if to flee where they are. And a lot of that, the folks that I spoke with indicated, is driven out of sheer necessity. If you have a child, for example, it's being threatened by gang violence, it's being threatened directly by gangs, you may want to immediately try and get that child out of the area, send them up to the United States for refuge to seek asylum. That kicks off a whole slew of other considerations. Do you have the money to do that? Will you pay a smuggler? Are there people who you know who are going with whom you can send the child? There are all these considerations come into place. Once you actually get to the border of the United States, though, there's a whole other set of considerations. What do you do? Should you go to a port of entry and wait and try and seek asylum there, which we have seen, although there's some indications this is changing too, that people were being turned away or being forced to wait outside of ports of entry, that is border crossing points, official border crossing points, before they could go in and seek asylum. Do you instead cross the border where there isn't a port of entry and turn yourself over to Border Patrol agents, which is something that a lot of immigrants have done? They have, instead of going to a port of entry, they have simply crossed the border, found a Border Patrol agent, said, hey, I'm here to seek asylum, and start that process that way. So there are all these decisions that guide essentially the core discussion around immigration on our border. And the decisions that are made by immigrants are on one end forced by necessity and on the other end shaped by what the existing law is in the United States.
And so before I let you go, when people say, why can't they just turn around if they're facing, this terrible situation of having to be separated from their children, for example, or if they're having such a hard time even getting their asylum case heard, waiting days, things like that, what is your response?
I mean, the response quite simply is if you lived in a neighborhood in which you knew there was a guy down the street who murdered people and he said he was going to murder your child, what would you do with your child? Would you think, oh, well, if I send him on this arduous journey to the United States, he may get turned away, so it's not worth it? I mean, the decision a lot of people are making is, no, I need to save the life of my child. This is an outlet that exists, sending him on this very difficult and dangerous journey in and of itself. The fact that that journey is so dangerous is already not serving as a deterrent for a lot of these people. And that's the thing to consider. Not everyone, obviously, is, leaving at the end of a gun barrel. But there are a lot of people, and the spike is clearly related to that criminal activity, and that is a fundamentally very visceral decision that people are making.
Philip Bump, national correspondent for The Washington Post, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you, ma'am.
And joining us for the rest of the hour, Karen Musalo. She's professor of law and director of the Center for Gender and Refugee Studies at UC Hastings. Good morning, Karen Musalo.
Good morning, Mina. Thank you for having me on.
Thanks for being here. We're also joined by Yoenn Grillo. He's a journalist based in Mexico City. His book is Gangster Warlords, Drug Dollars, Killing Fields, and the New Politics of Latin America. Good morning, Yoenn Grillo. Yoenn Grillo, are you there? Well, we'll try to connect with him shortly. In the meantime, Karen Musalo, we heard a little bit about, what goes through the mind of a parent, a child, a family, as they're considering leaving a country potentially at the end of a barrel of a gun, as Philip Bump put it, or because a child has witnessed a crime. But can you tell us, you have heard a lot of stories over the years. Can you tell us what exactly that means? What happens to a child that witnesses a crime? What kind of crime are they witnessing?
So I think, I really appreciate that you started this hour with Philip Bump, really bringing in the context from which people are fleeing, because there just is so much conversation about why are they coming and, can't they just stay home?
And we often hear that it's because of violence, but I think that that's just too broad a term to understand what is really happening in people's lives.
Yes. So, just in the broader context, the Northern Triangle countries are countries that have the highest homicide rates in the world. El Salvador and Honduras sort of trade off as often being number one or number two in terms of the highest rates of homicide globally. And that's really just to give you a sense of the dimension of it. And Guatemala is also within the top 10, and not just homicides, but then there's high levels of violence against women and children. There's a term that's used, the term femicides, which denotes killings that are gender motivated, that have no other perceptible motivation other than the fact that the victim was a woman. And you have these countries being the countries that have the highest rates of femicides in the world. So within that, if we say what concretely, what are the stories of the people who are fleeing, you may have a child who goes to school in an area that's controlled by gangs, lives in an area controlled by an opposing gang, basically is told by each gang that he must join, ultimately is threatened at home and threatened at school, has to drop out of school, goes into hiding in his home or her home, and becomes really a prisoner within the home because there simply is no way to live. This would be a young person who would know that basically if he or she doesn't accede to the demands of the gangs to join, he or she will in fact be killed. This is known. People see those killings taking place of others who have refused to join. And I think in that case, one of the tragedies that we need to look at is, you know, young people who actually don't want to join the gangs, who risk being killed because they disagree at a fundamental level with joining in violence and criminality, many of them are the ones that are fleeing, and they are the ones who, in a way, we should protect. They represent the values that I think we should all respect. It's somebody who at heart is akin to a conscientious objector saying, mm-hmm. I don't want to take part in something that violates my conscience. So that could be one example of the type of person who would flee a young person. You have other instances very common of girls who are singled out both to join the gang and or to be put in quotes, the girlfriend, because girlfriend really connotes that it's a consensual relationship, but it's not. But a gang member may tell a young girl, she may catch his eye and is told that she must be the partner of that gang member. And if she refuses, she knows that she may just be taken by force and raped or killed. And so this is also a very common type of scenario. Those are just two of the many, many other kinds of cases that we see yes. time and time again.
And your answer is focused on gangs, which leads me to ask the question, is gang violence, should it be a legitimate basis for asylum? And the reason I ask is because Attorney General Jeff Sessions suggested that it would no longer be considered one in the United States.
So I will answer that question and just want to, you know, sort of note for perhaps picking up a little bit later in the conversation. I started with gangs, but really there are high levels of violence that also have to do with that also come out of sort of machismo and high levels of the gender violence that exists that are really deeply embedded in the society. And so that's a whole other sort of set of circumstances to discuss. But when you ask the question of should fear of gangs be a basis for protection, and Attorney General Sessions did suggest that it should not be, I mean, what we are a country of rule of law, and we have adopted in our laws a definition of who is a refugee. So when you ask that question broadly, really the way to answer it is, do these claims fit within the refugee definition? And I don't want to get overly technical, but just to say, you know, the way a refugee is defined both in U.S. law as well as in international law is a person who either has suffered persecution or has what's called a well-founded fear of persecution that has to be linked to five what we call grounds, and they are race, religion, nationality, political opinion, or membership in a particular social group. So when we look at these gang claims, these are individuals who clearly have a well-founded fear of persecution. They fear being raped, beaten, killed, forced to join a gang and engage in activities that are deeply abhorrent to them on a level of conscience. And the question then is, but is it on account of one of those five grounds? Because if it is, then they do meet the refugee definition. And regardless of Jeff Sessions' opinion about whether they qualify or not, if they meet the refugee definition, they're entitled to protection. And so there's this whole discussion about whether certain categories of individuals who flee the gangs would fit within one of those five grounds. Let me give you an example. Many cases we see are of young people who are deeply religious, very active in their churches, whether it be Catholic or evangelical, and they believe that criminality is wrong, and they not only that is not only underlying their reason for not wanting to join the gang, but they may go out and actively proselytize to other young people and encourage them not to join the gangs, and may even go so far as to try to get gang members to leave the gangs. So in a case like that, if a young person is targeted, one could say this is persecution on account of religion. There might be other cases where an individual is targeted because of other things about that individual, where under the law it could be properly argued that they come within this ground called a particular social group. And again, these are highly technical legal issues, but the law as it has developed really does provide a basis for arguing that certain groupings of people, young people or whatever the characteristics, women, girls, targeted by gangs, would fit within this particular social group ground and would meet the refugee definition. And that's why I think we have to be careful. You know, Jeff Sessions, and I've sort of said this before, he's not a king. He doesn't dictate the outcome. We have laws and we have courts, and we all know that, you know, fairness requires that each case is decided with an application of the law to the facts of that case. And many of these cases of individuals fleeing gangs would meet the refugee definition, notwithstanding Jeff Sessions' opinion to the contrary.
Well, we're looking at what's behind the growing number of migrants, refugees, asylum seekers showing up at the U.S.-Mexico border, specifically from places like Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador. Why they're risking a dangerous journey here in the face of prosecution threats and family separations. Joan Grillo, are you with us? Joan Grillo, are you there? It sounds like we're still having a little trouble with his line. We will try again. In the meantime, one of the things that has come up, of course, in these countries is the reality of drug cartels and the power that they have in communities. How linked is that to gang violence? Is it all something that, you know, works together?
Well, I think if we think of this larger term of sort of organized crime, and we have gangs and we have drug cartels, and there's some, and this isn't my area of expertise, it really is Ian Grillo's area, but there is this relationship between gangs and drug cartels, more collaboration, for instance, between the gangs in the Northern Triangle countries with some of the drug cartels in Mexico.
And more collaboration and as well with police, even, as I understand from our next guest, who is Alma Hernandez. She came to the U.S. from Guatemala in 1998 with her mother and five siblings. She was just 15 years old. Good morning, Alma Hernandez.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for joining us. Tell us your story.
Yeah, well, I came to the United States in 1982, so my bad. Yeah, we left Guatemala. We came in 1992, so we left Guatemala for the reasons of my mom was a single mom. We lived alone in a house, and the guerrilla came in, and they were looking for weapons and money that we did not have. We were poor by that time.
And just explain what the guerrilla is.
The guerrilla, it's a group of people dressed up by military, and they wear masks, but they were not. It's a group of people just going into homes and representing military and just stealing from poor people.
And they were demanding money from your mother?
They were demanding money from my mom. They were looking for weapons. We didn't have weapons by that time. We didn't have no money. So we only had, like, we are farmers, so we had chickens and corn and sesame seed. That's all we had. So they ended up taking our chickens and our sesame seed. But by that time, it was really, like, traumatic because they were trying to take us as girls with them, and they were trying to, like, rape us, but my mom was begging them, so he was really traumatized at that time.
I'm so sorry.
That's one of the reasons that we left our home, and then we ended up at our grandpa's house in they threatened us. If we will say anything, they will come back and kill us. So that's one of the reasons that we came to this country to apply for asylum.
And what do you remember about your trip through Mexico?
My trip to Mexico, it took us 1 month. We were in buses trying to cross Mexico City, and we got caught 2 times with my cousins who were joining us to come here too. And we ended up in jail, and there was people from Honduras, El Salvador, even Nicaragua, and they burned a garbage trash can, and we were like getting suffocated, you know, because of the smoke, and the police would not open the jail to get us out. So that was traumatizing for me. It's something that I still, you know, when I remember, I tear up. And the second time it was the same thing too, because we they trap us in the bus. They were thinking that we were not from Mexico. So that was another thing right there. I saw somebody getting, you know, like trying to commit suicide inside because, you know, they were stressed out for the situation that we were in jail.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
That's okay.
So when you hear these stories of why migrants are coming now, the things that they are facing, what's your reaction? Are you struck by a sense that little has changed since you left in 1992?
It has changed, but definitely I will, like, if I want to go to Guatemala, there's a lot of gangs going on, and they're taking our little towns in control. Like, if I want to go back into my country, you know, if I want to like establish a little store, I will have to pay these gangs just for having my store, and I will be like, I will not live in peace because of all these gangs that are going on in my country, like the 18th Street, you know, like last, how would you say this, Salvatruchas, you know, there's people from Salvador living in Guatemala too, so it's not the same as, there's not that much difference.
Mm. And where do you live and what do you do now?
I live in San Rafael. I'm a preschool teacher.
And
I have 3 kids.
Well, Alma Hernandez, we really appreciate you sharing your story with us today. If there's one thing that you'd like people to understand about the experiences of people showing up at our border, what would you like them to hear?
I would like them to, you know, if I was one of them, I would like to have our family together and not being separated, because this is what's going on right now. They're separating kids from their families. I would wish, you know, if they become illegal in this country, and then we can be a good society for this country.
Alma Hernandez, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
We're taking a closer look at what's happening in Central America and what's behind the growing number of migrants, refugees, and asylum seekers from this region showing up at the U.S.-Mexico border. What are your questions? Please give us a call at 866-733-6786. Post your comments on our website, kqed.org/forum. Email us, forum@kqed.org, or find us at Facebook and Twitter. I'm Mina Kim. Stay with us. This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're looking at what's behind the number of migrants, refugees showing up at the U.S.-Mexico border, particularly from what's called the Northern Triangle of Central America, Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador. We're hearing from human rights groups that this region is beset by violence associated with drug trafficking, gang proliferation, and even official corruption. And we're talking with Karen Musalo. She's a professor of law and director of the Center for Gender and Refugee Studies at UC Hastings. And Joanne Grillo, a journalist based in Mexico City. Joanne Grillo, are you finally there?
Yeah, I'm here, yes.
Okay, Joanne, glad that you are, because one of the things that I wanted to talk with you about was what's being called corruption on an official level, on a government, on a law enforcement level. And this is something that you've really looked into, and even something that our last guest, Alma Hernandez, touched on in terms of guerrilla showing up at her door seeking money or bribes. Can you talk about how that has also affected the lives of some of the people who are showing up at our border?
Yeah, sure. So I mean, okay, you know, the case, this case of different countries, in the case of Mexico, where we've got enormous corruption, enormous links between drug cartels and and the police, drug cartels and politicians. But also in the case of Honduras, you also see that. Now, for an example, I've had the opportunity to interview quite a lot of the assassins, quite a lot of the gang members and people carrying out these hits, carrying out this violence, to try and understand what's driving them and why they're doing it. And in one example of a guy I talked to who carried out 38 contract killings, 38 murders, and a lot of people who were paying him to do those hits in Honduras were politicians themselves. So you get politicians themselves paying these people to commit violent acts, and you get a lot of that across Latin America. So this comes in very importantly, I think, to the asylum cases. And this really challenges the ruling by Jeff Sessions. He was saying, well, it's just generalized violence. We're not going to give asylum to these people. We can't help people around the world just because there's violence in their countries. But when you have a government involved with these criminals, then that is the government itself persecuting people. So if you're in a country, and it can be in Honduras, it can be in Mexico, and you have a hit on you by a cartel, but that cartel has connections with the police and with politicians, then you really have no protection. And that's why in so many of these cases, people can't go to the police in Mexico or the police in Honduras or in El Salvador. They run. Now, also in many cases...
Oh, it looks like we lost the line with you, Yoen. Karen Musalo, the other thing that we heard, besides the fact that there is official corruption, gang proliferation... Alma Hernandez touched on this, but also poverty. And one of the things that has been suggested that drives migrants is just their economic situation. First, do you feel like the violence piece of this that drives people is overblown and that really people are coming here to seek better lives economically?
Yeah, I think that the violence piece of it is not overblown. As I said at the top of the hour, these are countries that have the highest homicide rates in the entire world. These are countries with the highest femicide rates globally. And so when you have those levels of violence, it just defies logic to say that those aren't the motivating factors. There are other countries that are equally in poor economic conditions in Central America. We don't see the numbers of people seeking asylum, and Nicaragua would be a good comparison point where you have, you know, somewhat equivalent levels of poverty, but you absolutely don't see the exodus of individuals. So I don't think there is any doubt by anybody who's given a thoughtful look to the information about these countries to say that it is, you know, that the push factor is economics rather than these horrific levels of violence that people are confronting.
Well, Nathan asked the question, I'd like to hear some discussion about why sending the children to the U.S. seems to be the only option. I'm sure that many children are sent to other parts of their home country or to countries other than the U.S., but I think that there is a widespread perception that they only come here. Karen Musalo?
Yeah, so there has been, you know, in terms of people fleeing the Northern Triangle countries, it is true that many of them seek, you know, come to the U.S., and there are reasons for that. We are perceived as being a beacon of liberty and a country that protects people fleeing persecution. And there also, we have a long history with these countries in Central America going back to foreign policy choices that we made and entwinement and entanglement, not all of it good, that we had with these three countries. And so there are communities of Salvadorans, Guatemalans, and Hondurans, which makes it a natural place for people fleeing persecution to go where they have communities and family and friends. But they are going to other countries within the region. There's been an uptick in asylum seekers from the Northern Triangle going to, for instance, Nicaragua or Costa Rica or Belize. But I do want to, if I can just say one other thing about why the U.S., and I think this is an important point that goes to, does the U.S. have a responsibility besides its refugee laws, which we, you know, really obligated to protect people fleeing persecution? You know, we... all three of these countries, El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, the U.S. engaged in activities that really have contributed to the levels of government dysfunction and violence. We funded the Salvadoran brutal military during its long civil war. We participated in a coup that overthrew the democratically elected president of Guatemala in 1954. And we used Honduras for our purposes during our war against Nicaragua and used it as a launch pad for the Contras. So those who have sort of a long memory of our relationship with these countries in Latin America can say there's also a moral responsibility because we took actions as part of our foreign policy that has led to the levels of violence and impunity for that violence and dysfunction that prevail today.
And I think that's what our listener Cindy wanted us to touch on. Please discuss how previous U.S. involvement in these countries have helped to create the destruction that people are now fleeing. Let me go to our phones as well as our online comments. Roger in San Francisco, what would you like to say?
Yes, thank you. We have long had a mechanism to control those situations in countries that the governments can't handle, and that is the UN. We have the capacity to send peacekeepers to areas that are uncontrollable.
So you're wondering why they're not being used in these cases?
Yes, absolutely. If the government is incapable of controlling the violence in their country with their own mechanisms, perhaps some outside force other than the United States should get involved. And I think the UN is peacekeepers are an ideal choice, not only in South America, but all over the world where we find ourselves involved with.
Okay. Well, let me get Karen Musalo's thoughts on that.
I think that There's certainly Roger's comment really goes to the fact that we should address the root cause of this problem, which is the violence in these countries. And I couldn't agree with him more. And the UN has had a role in various of these countries and currently has a role trying to deal, for instance, with having their law enforcement and judicial system work more effectively. But it's not easy to transform these countries. And I would just sort of make the point that the U.S., you know, when it talks about spending as much money as Trump would like to spend, for instance, in building a wall or other measures that we're spending now to keep people out, along the lines that Roger suggested, if we use that money and invested it, worked with reliable partners in these countries to try to address the situation, that would go a long way and be a much more productive way than trying to just return people. You know, our current policy is, you know, house is on fire. Let's throw people back into the burning house instead of saying let's put out the fire. So I think Roger's point is well taken. And whether it's the UN or some combination of UN and U.S. foreign policy investments, that would be a great way to address the catastrophe.
Well, I think
that's engulfed these countries.
Would want you to expand on that because Beth writes, there's no way America can afford to take in millions from Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. What can be done to help make these countries safe again? First of all, are we looking at millions and is there more that can be done? What do you mean when you say foreign policy investments?
So there really are not millions. If we look at the historical numbers of how many individuals from the Northern Triangle countries have sought asylum in the U.S., it doesn't anywhere approach millions. And, you know, just as a matter of looking at other countries and their response to refugee flows, the U.S., with its size and its, over 330 million and our economic situation, we are not to capacity. It's not a stretch for us to do more and to take in and adjudicate these claims. But I do want to say that this isn't a matter just of choice. We actually are a party to the refugee protocol, and we have a law that obligates us not to return people fleeing persecution. And so I think we have to start from that point that we have a legal obligation And at the same time, it would be smart to try to address the root cause because, believe it or not, most people in these countries don't want to come to the U.S. I think there's a perception that everybody in the world wants to come to the U.S. But the hundreds of people that I've spoken to over the years, it was a decision that was actually a heartbreaking, anguished decision to make to leave everything behind and to come to the U.S.
And when you say we are a party to the Refugee Protocol, you're talking about an international treaty that we signed.
So we signed there's the 1967 Refugee Protocol, and in order to comply with our obligations that we undertook by becoming a party, we enacted what's called the 1980 Refugee Act.
I see.
And it we agreed not to return people to persecution, both in U.S. law and through becoming a party to the treaty.
And again, Karen Musallo is professor of law and director of the Center for Gender and Refugee Studies at UC Hastings. I go now to Reynolds in San Francisco. Hi, Reynolds.
Hi. I personally have volunteered in Norway, and I got deported from the country for volunteering in excess of my work visa. And so I have experience with sort of international issues. My question is primarily immigrants or refugees that are seeking asylum are, in according to European perspective, supposed to seek in the country they first enter. So the country of El Salvador has a relatively small population, not bigger than Dallas-Fort Worth. So even if we took everyone in the country, it wouldn't be that many people. But why are they not seeking asylum in Mexico first as part of my understanding?
Reynolds, thank you. And also, just to add Stephen's question to that, because it's related, Karen Musallo, he asked, do some of the Central Americans seek asylum in Mexico? Does Mexico accept them? Why do most continue on to the U.S.? Is it because of greater economic opportunity here?
So there is no obligation in the law that individuals seek asylum in the first country that they pass through. That is not the case with that's just not a legal requirement. But the reason that people generally don't – some number of those traveling through Mexico do seek asylum in Mexico. But Mexico has comparably high levels of violence. And, you know, I'm sorry that we lost Ian Griot, but he was talking about these levels of violence and corruption and drug cartels in Mexico. So Mexico is simply not a safe place. Many of the Central Americans who try to get to the U.S. traveling through Mexico are beaten, raped, killed, extorted. So it simply is not a safe place in which individuals could be expected to seek protection.
But my understanding was there was a decline in 2015-2016 of migrants showing up to the U.S. border, in part because there was some cooperation with Mexico to try to at least maybe process some asylum cases in that country before entering, or rather than having people continue on to the U.S.
So the Obama administration, which also wasn't as humanitarian as some people might have thought they would be towards refugees, when there was an increase in unaccompanied minors coming to the U.S. in around 2014 is when it got a lot of media attention. The U.S. did pressure Mexico to prevent these Central Americans from reaching the northern border. And the Mexicans, you know, acceded to that pressure and did stop their travel. And there were more Mexicans who may have applied for protection in the country. But that is, you know, if we look at Mexico and its own human rights violations and the weakness of its refugee protection system, which is relatively new, it is simply not reasonable or fair or consistent with our international obligations to say that, you know, we can just turn them away because Mexico can and should take them as refugees.
So you're saying that's not a good option? It's not.
It's not a good option simply because Mexico has neither the human rights protections. These asylum seekers are not safe in Mexico, nor does it have the legal infrastructure set up to fairly decide these claims. And that's been documented by human rights organizations who have looked at the treatment of asylum seekers in Mexico.
Well, let me thank Reynolds for the question and go to Yogi in San Jose. Hi, Yogi.
Yeah, hi.
What's your question? Yes.
So even if you take into account the history between the U.S. and the three countries and the current situation and the reasons for that, I just want to see why we seem to have money to have to house these asylum seekers for an average of 1,000 to 500 days here, but no money to invest in financial aid for these countries. And also, you know, the drug cartels, they're not philanthropic organizations. They're doing it for the money. We are partly to blame because we are creating the incentive to make these drugs for them to sell here. So I don't see any politicians talking about that. I wonder why that's the case.
Thank you, Yogi.
Thank you, Yogi. That's a really good question. And you make the point about how much money is being spent on detention. And I think, you know, the figures are at least $130 per person per day. And what is, you know, but detention is you know, the argument is that these individuals need to be detained or they won't show up for their court hearings. But this administration terminated a program that was very successful, had a success rate of almost 100% of individuals showing up who had been released from detention, but were, you know, had a social worker assigned to them to work with them and assure they would show up for all of their proceedings. Almost 100% success rate at a cost of, I think, something like $36 a day per person as compared to the 136 or whatever for detention. So it doesn't have to be an either or of we either allow them to seek asylum here and detain them or we take that money and invest it in these countries. I think that we can be compassionate and smart and do both, not keep people in detention and waste all the money that that requires, and also, you know, have a smart foreign policy. It's really in our interest as a country to have stable, democratically functioning countries at our border. And so that investment really makes sense for a lot of reasons.
Well, Yogi, thanks for the question. Let me go next to John in Palo Alto. Hi, John.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. A couple observations. First, the desired outcome of this administration is very similar to the stated goal of the previous administration, which was to use detention, this is the Obama policy, use detention to deter illegal entry. So there's a bit of amnesia and even hypocrisy going on here. Second point is that we are now moving this discussion so far to the left, so far beyond common sense, that this issue is actually going to help Trump get reelected. We're now hearing people say that ICE should be abolished. I'm now hearing the guests on the program say that we need to rescue and reform Mexico. If you think building a wall is costly, think about reforming Mexico. This will help Trump, and I don't think it serves anybody's interest to fan the flames of hysteria about the current administration's approach to this. It's really not much different,
John,
from the Obama administration.
Karen Musall,
thanks.
You certainly have made the point that the Obama administration also took a hardline position when it came to migrants.
Yes, this, you know, in 2014, when the media really started writing about this increase in unaccompanied minors coming to our borders, Obama and his entire administration took a very punitive approach. Up until that point, we virtually did not detain families. If families entered seeking asylum, they were not detained. We had only one detention center in the entire United States with a capacity for 84 individuals. As there, you know, there was this noticeable increase in asylum seekers coming, President Obama decided that there was going to be family detention again. And two large detention centers were opened in Texas that had a capacity together of over 3,500. So I don't have amnesia, and most other people who work in the area don't have amnesia about the fact that the Obama administration really, unfortunately, didn't take the right didn't have the right response. Under, you know, our law and under international law, detention is not supposed to be used as a deterrent, and it was wrong when Obama did it, and it's wrong when Trump does it. In terms of taking the conversation to the left, you know, my point wasn't that we should, although I really appreciate John's observations, but my point wasn't that we should rescue and reform Mexico, but more that when we think about you know, foreign policy and what is smart foreign policy from the United States, it really is in the interest of the United States to work with other countries so that those countries are democratic, you know, fully functioning democratic countries that don't have income inequalities and massive human rights violations, because those are the things that will make them good neighbors, and those are are better solutions to high levels of migration and refugee flows.
Could you also spell out what, though, are the specific differences between the family separation policy between the two administrations? Because this is something that has come up quite a bit, where even the family separation issue has been basically said it was originally an Obama administration practice as well.
Right. So what the Obama administration did was family detention. It wasn't separating. But as I said, prior to 2014, the U.S. really didn't detain families anymore. There was a recognition that it was so deleterious and so traumatic to detain families and children that we just stopped doing it. So what the Obama administration did is reinstituted family detention. But families were not separated. They were, for the most part, kept together. What the Trump administration has done is a major departure, which there's a lot I could say about, but just most pertinent to your point is it's family separation and detention. So not only are families, you know, parents and children being detained, but they're being separated, which is even more traumatic than detention of these families together. And just to make the point again that this is being used as a deterrent, which is really impermissible.
Well, let's hear from Greg in Redwood City. Hi, Greg.
Good morning. I'm sympathetic to your deport flight, but the reality is I'd like to hear your guests build on the story, like what happens after they get here. The UN just did a report that 50 million Americans are now below the poverty line, 5 million are in abject poverty. You know, we have the detour burden going to communities that are already struggling and don't have resources to pull their own children out of poverty. You know, what's the rest of the picture look like for the country and the rest of the, you know, story for all of this?
Karen Musal, this is something we hear quite a bit.
Yeah, and I really agree with Greg that we need to be concerned for all Americans who are not enjoying the standard of living that they should be entitled to, and that anyone is living in deprivation is a tragedy given the wealth of this country. But I would say that what's resulting in the income inequality in this country isn't as a result of us having compassion and welcoming refugees. There's been economic study after economic study that shows that immigrants in general and refugees specifically contribute a net benefit to our economy, that they create, they result in the creation of more jobs and a more robust economy. And I think there are some demagogues who would like to say, you know, the reason that people are poor and are suffering, and they want to point at those who are even less fortunate and say it's their fault and set the people at the bottom to fight for the crumbs, instead of saying, look at the fabulous wealth that people at the top have, and look at how this so-called tax reform gave them even more. And so I'm all with Greg's point, is we need to do more to really eliminate the tragic and unjust income inequalities that exist in our country and take care of all of our citizens. But we don't have to do that by sacrificing people who are fleeing horrific conditions from around the world. We should do our fair share and be compassionate and really live up to our image as a beacon of liberty and justice.
Well, let me try to get one more quick call in, and that would be Rebecca from Napa. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi. Yeah, I was calling. I was curious if you knew if Donald Trump had plans to visit these countries all the immigrants are coming from. I know Obama had visited multiple times and tried to talk with them about how they can improve the violence in their countries. And I just hadn't heard if Trump was doing that. He seems to only be talking badly about them, and I
I was curious. I can take my answer off the air.
Karen Musalo, do you know?
Yeah. No, I don't know. I do think that there have been some of some representatives from the State Department that have visited some of the countries, but just I haven't seen any conversations about really addressing the root cause of the issues coming out of this administration.
Well, Larissa tweets, the absence of Central American leaders' voices is starting to really hurt the root cause of this mass exodus. It stems back 40-plus years when the U.S. financed the military apparatus that perpetuates this violence. In addition, the U.S. has canceled temporary protected status and wants to send beneficiaries back to violence. There's a hearing today in San Francisco about temporary protected status for people. I don't believe that it includes Honduras, but it does include El Salvador. Can you say a little bit about what effect that could have? And we just have 30 seconds or so, Karen Musalo.
Yeah, I really appreciate Larissa's comment, and I think it's very much true that our policies have caused much of the suffering and conditions, and that ending TPS is only worsening a situation for individuals from these countries.
And because will those who are here on TPS, temporary protected status, who have U.S. citizen kids, will they be separated from their kids?
They will be separated from their kids. They will, they will lose their legal status. And if they don't have another remedy, could go into, could be removed, put in removal proceedings and removed.
Finally, one last point. Are people who are deported or returned, do we know at what rate they are persecuted or killed ultimately?
You know, that's been very hard fact to nail down. There have been some stories and some researchers that have shown that it is not an uncommon occurrence, and there have been a number of documented cases. So this is a real risk. It's not just a rhetorical flourish to say these are people who are fleeing for their lives.
Karen Musalo of UC Hastings, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me on, Mina.
I'm Mina Kim. Another Hour of Forum is next. Stay with us.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, who believe that all people deserve access to education and culture to enrich a lifetime of exploration and learning.